Session number 10059.
So Geoffrey Cox, reel 3.
Now, I've opposed a great deal of what the communists have done in my lifetime, but there was this one period in Madrid, perhaps because I shared the dangers with them, I regard them at that stage as having been a good thing.
Were you able to understand the working class British chaps who joined the International Brigade?
Yes, many of them did so because they were had a rough ride with unemployment. It was perhaps better than kicking your heels on the dole. They were, the interesting thing was that in those days, of course, there was a noticeable physical difference between the working class and the upper class, that physically a great many members of the working class were smaller in stature. They were white, very often white-faced from malnutrition or bad housing. They very often had bad teeth, and this was particularly noticeable once you got into the war. I remember when I was in a troop ship on the way to the Middle East, when we lined up on the dockside at Cape Town for a route march, the New Zealand battalion that I was with was lined up on one side of the quay, and a British column of mainly of drivers and signalers was lined up on the other side, and I would say there could have been an average of 6 inches difference in the height between the two groups. And these were small, stunted men, but I think these chaps were fighting partly from political conviction, and no doubt also from a sort of instinct that this was the working class standing up for itself, and they would go and do so.
How is it that you came to know Giles Romilly so comparatively well?
Because I later worked with him in the early stages of the war. We covered the Russo-Finnish war together, and I was the chief Daily Express correspondent in Finland, and Giles was my assistant. And we spent a great deal of time together there, and that's where I really learnt of to know him well, and also to hear his experiences in Spain, because he was ultimately, of course, after fighting with great bravery in the Battle of Brunete, he was arrested in Alicante, I think, and imprisoned as a suspect British spy and or Trotskyist, and was got out only by pressure from the British government. But he had enlisted later. He was Esmond's older brother, I think. I'm not sure whether he was the older or the younger. I think he was the older brother. And I think he enlisted after Esmond had left, because although Esmond fought very valiantly, he also fought very briefly with the International Brigade, and came away. Giles went in, and Giles was certainly there, I think, for the best part of a year.
Is there anything that Giles Romilly told you about his participation in the war, Spanish War, that sticks in your mind?
Only that being shelled is rather like having the dentist using a drill on a rather raw tooth. And secondly, that, as I say, this remark about when we discussed the what courage consisted of, he made this remark. But on the ideology of it, he had got increasingly disillusioned with the Stalinist control of the International Brigade, and which by that time was beginning to be really damaging, I think, to morale, and which people were disappearing because they'd possibly put a foot out of line, and the party line. And after all, Stalin, I think, bumped off virtually all the people. Kleber, for instance, Stern, the commander of the International Brigade, almost certainly was killed, and I think a great many of them were. And I think a sense that which increased that you were fighting against one totalitarian system for another that was becoming increasingly totalitarian, I think spread a great deal of disillusion through these, through the minds of many people like Romilly. Other people felt, well, nevertheless, the main immediate evil that we know is an evil, which is Hitler, has got to be fought. And if the Russians prove to be badens, well, we'll face that one in the long run. But we know for certain what Hitler is, and we'd better stand up to him.
Were you in a position to see anything of this change in control of the international brigades?
No, I had it all at second hand, because I didn't go back to Spain after December 1936, but I was a correspondent in Paris right through 38 and through much 38 and 39, and through Paris came and went all the people coming from Spain. And I also had a very good friend in the Spanish embassy, the press attaché in the Spanish embassy in Paris. And I got this increasing sense of sad disillusion coming through in all except the ardent dyed-in-the-wool Stalinists. Part of this was, of course, war fatigue, but there's no doubt that the issue which seemed to me absolutely black and white in that autumn of 36 became muddied to increasingly a grey as the years went on.
Whilst you were there in Spain, apart from what you've already said about one Russian officer, did you have much contact with Soviet help to the Republic?
No, I saw it. I must have seen the very first Russian tanks to arrive on the front, because on the Sunday before the Franco reached Madrid, I was on the Hill of the Angels with Louis Fisher, who had been the famous correspondent of the Nation, the American Nation, in Moscow, and had been one of the great apologists for the Soviet regime, and was employed in Spain as virtually, as I think, one of the early commissars of the National Brigade. But at this stage, in any case, he was simply working as a journalist, and he and I were on this hill, and we came down off it and found, I suppose, 20 or 30 tanks in an olive grove at the bottom, and Fisher, who spoke perfect Russian, spoke to the chap, and these were Soviet tanks that had just arrived on the scene. And they had, in fact, gone into action 48 hours before. The first story I sent from Madrid when I got there was of the Republican counterattack, which was the counterattack launched on the flank of the advancing Franco forces in which these tanks were employed, and which, if there'd been any discipline among the infantry that went with them, could have done Franco great damage. But because the Republican infantry had no means of, they didn't run away, but they didn't arrive at the right place at the right time, and they were out of contact with the tanks and everything. And then I saw the Soviet fighters over Madrid, and whenever I went forward to one of these frontline areas, you could quickly spot the Russian in his very often in a leather jacket in the corner. And of course I did see and have a long talk with two or three other correspondents with Stern, Kleber, as he called himself, when he first surfaced as the leader of the International Brigade. A delegation of British MPs, Wing Commander James, and one name I remember, and Grenfell of the Labour Party, and two Labour and two Tory and a Liberal, so there must have been five, Wilfred Roberts from the Liberal Party, came out to Madrid in either late November or early December. And we went up to Kleber's headquarters with them. And this was when the conservative, one of the conservative members, whose name escapes me for the moment, who'd been a soldier in World War I, and although his sympathies were probably not with the Republic, he was so excited at finding himself in a battle headquarters once again that he couldn't resist advising Kleber where he should move and how he should fight the battle. And Kleber was busy acting the role of the Canadian who had been a Canadian born, who had fought in the Hungarian army in the war and had become a member of the Red Army. And in fact, he was, of course, a Red Army officer assigned for the task. Very impressive man indeed, and very good-humoured, because one of the more vain of these MPs said that they noticed that the headquarters had not been shelled while they were there. Did he think that it was the presence of the British MPs that had halted the shelling? And Kleber said, no, I think it's because I've got a Mexican artillery officer who can shoot rather straight, and they don't like shooting at us because we shoot back rather too effectively. But he was obviously a very able officer.
Was that what was impressive about him, his military capacity?
And of course I did see, although I didn't see the British unit, unfortunately, in action, I saw the Poles and the Belgians and the French in the university city and spent quite a lot of time with them. And they were a remarkable group, that early international brigade, because these were all, very many of them, refugees from their own countries. They were the people who had come into communism before you could get anything out of being a communist. These were certainly not apparatchiks. They were not people eager to make to gain anything. These were men like Ludwig Renn and others of this kind who were, and they had all made a very considerable individual decision to get there. And of course, after the war, they were to have play a huge influence in, and during the war, a huge influence in the on the Russian and Soviet side. I mean, Tito, I don't think, was ever in Spain, but certainly the main Luigi Longo, the chief of the trade unions in Trieste, was there, and there was another man I saw a great deal of in Rome in the closing stages of the war, who was an Italian liberal who had been a key member of the Italian battalion of the International Brigade.
How did the International Brigades compare, militarily speaking, with the Spanish Republican Army?
Oh, at that stage, they were incomparably better organized and disciplined. They had in their ranks a considerable number of men who had had experience in World War I. They were well equipped. They had an absolutely steel discipline from imposed by the Communist Party, but nevertheless readily accepted themselves. And they were men, desperate men who had served in concentration camps and whose lives were hardened by years of either the First World War, post-war experience. And these were men who, in the language I learnt later to use when I became a soldier myself, were prepared to accept a high level of casualties. And the early international brigades had very high casualties. Now, the Spaniards were prepared to die also, but these were, at this stage, they were a powerfully disciplined military unit in the way that the Spanish and Republican Army was not yet. And above all, they were organized to fight. They'd been very hastily brought together, but because they had this considerable element of veteran fighters among them, who passed their knowledge on to other people very quickly, there's no doubt that they played an essential role in the defense of Madrid. Madrid would have fallen in November 36, but for the arrival of the International Brigade. That is not to say that they alone saved the city. They were simply, as it were, the particular steel tip on the end of a sword that was composed of the rest of the Republican army. They certainly did not do all the fighting. The burden of the battle was borne by the Spaniards, but this was an absolutely invaluable element of seasoned troops who were able to resist at the key points where Franco could have got through. And of course, it was later shown that Franco didn't have enough troops to do more than smash his way into Madrid at the first go. He had to get in with a real thrust or face a long, long battle, which of course he never won. He won the war elsewhere. And in that initial shock, in the first 10 days in the Casa del Campo and in the university city, the Spaniards would probably have lost if they had not had the additional element of the International Brigade. On the other hand, the International Brigade on their own certainly couldn't have won it. So that it's wrong to give to credit the International Brigade with saving Madrid. They were, however, an element in saving the Madrid, an absolutely essential element.
You mentioned the Poles, the French, and the Belgians. Did those three national contingents strike you differently?
Yes. What was interesting was how very different each one of these units were. The Germans, left wing though they might be, extremely disciplined, strict, almost psychologically clicking their heels. The French, rather slapdash, the place reeking of Gaulois tobacco, rather dirty, but very dashing and very gallant. And the Poles, fiery and very keen to get at the enemy all the time. So the national, it was surprising how marked the national characters were, and the British at the same time really taking it all rather as a job of work with very few histrionics and settling down to endure it in a remarkable way.
You mean a stoical way?
Yes, without any... And I remember that being with Esmond Romilly and a couple of others in the brigade, I can't remember who they were, I think one of them could have been Birch, and Ivor Montague, the very wealthy communist from London, who had come out on behalf of the Communist Party on some propaganda mission. And I can remember him praising these chaps and talking in great grandiloquent tones about the anti-fascist struggle, and in a bar off the Grand Via. And when he looked at when he left, these chaps just looked at each other and shrugged their shoulders, and with absolute scorn that he had embarrassed them by talking in grandiloquent terms, which expressed their instincts in a way which embarrassed them. They didn't think in those terms. They didn't put things in those terms. They were there to fight a chap they saw as an enemy of a decent life. And it was as false, I felt, as if some propagandist had turned up in World War I and proceeded to preach some particularly patriotic theme to chaps in the trenches.
You mentioned the MPs, but were there any other VIP visits that you can recollect?
Not in my time. The first 10 days, fortnight of the bombardment, of the attack, everybody expected the city to fall all the time, and there was no great rush of anybody to come and be on the spot. Indeed, I was, when the actual attack came on the 7th of November, there were only three British correspondents left in Madrid, four if you counted De Coe, who was resident there, but there was Buckley of Reuters, and there was the correspondent Stubbs Walker of the Daily Herald and myself. The others, the Express man and various, there weren't any other daily paper men there, but there had been a great number of people from magazines and periodicals and so on. They'd all pulled out and gone to Valencia with the government. We stayed. The result was that we had the story to ourselves, and there were no American newspaper correspondents there at that stage, only the two American agencies. It was a very small press corps indeed, and which made it very much easier, because then you could get around the place quickly, and we were given, best of my recollection, accurate information. So I say I've checked my dispatches against Hugh Thomas, and except at one point where the Republic had claimed in its first major counterattack after the Franco had got engaged in Madrid, they counterattacked by the Hill of the Angels, and they claimed to reach Getafe, and they got nowhere near it. But that was their claim, and I reported it as a claim. But otherwise, among other things, it was an extraordinary battle, because we could see a great deal of it from the windows of the telephone building in Madrid. We could the part to the west of the city at that time, and the Casa del Campo, and also the area right around towards Carabanchel, was open country, and through field glasses you could see much of the fighting actually in the fields. If anything, this was a drawback, because we didn't go forward as much as I wish now I had in those first two or three days, because we had the illusion we could see it all from there through binoculars, and of course we were getting the details, the annual daily communiques. I wish, in fact, from my later experience, I would have, I had been very interested to have seen what it was like actually in the Casa del Campo at that time, because by the time that we got there, the first first rush had stopped, and they were down to positional fighting rather than the cut and thrust the first two or three days.
What about being able to send your reports back? Were you hampered at all in the way of censorship?
No, we were censored, and we telephoned. There were two telephone lines out of Madrid, and the press worked on, I think, the sixth floor of the telephone building. And we each had a desk there that we wrote our stories at, and we then telephoned them to London with a censor sitting opposite us, making sure that we did not depart from the script that we had in front of us. This was a very considerable journalistic training for me, because I found myself, as a relative newcomer, listening, once I'd put my own story over, to the stories that everybody else put over. And in particular, I learnt a great deal from the great Daily Express correspondent William Forrest, who was there, but who was withdrawn by his paper to Valencia. But in the days of coming up to the attack on Madrid, I would put over my story, and then here William Forrest put over his, and I must say that was a daily lesson in really top-class reporting.
And presumably people did obey the rules, did they?
Yes, there was no point in not doing so. I suppose the simple answer is that you would have been, you wouldn't. There was no way of smuggling material out. De Coe of the Times sent out a major dispatch through the British Embassy, which was printed in the Times early in January 1937, and in my view is one of the great classics of journalism of all time, in which he made the point that this magnificent fighting on the front line was being marred by the intermittent, not large scale, but constant butchery of Franco sympathizers behind the lines, that every day there were half a dozen bodies found in parks and areas of Madrid, and these were Franco sympathizers that had been killed. But it's a great piece of journalism, and I commend anybody that wants to know the sense of Madrid in at that time to read De Coe in the Times, the dispatch in the Times. It's unmistakable. It was by a special correspondent. I'm sure the Spanish Republic knew it was by De Coe, but I think on the whole, they were not averse to the knowledge of these killings being made known abroad, because they were doing their utmost to stop them themselves. I mean, these were mainly the anarchists and the extreme republicans at work. They were certainly not the socialists or the communists who had a grip on their people by that time.
Were you aware of the correspondence on the Franco side from Britain and elsewhere?
Only when the papers came through to us. We had some pleasure in noting the dispatches that many of them had written on the Saturday, describing how Franco had already taken Madrid, and a number of them sent back reports, assuming that the place had fallen to meet their deadline for the Sunday papers. When I say at least a couple of people wrote dispatches saying that the city had fallen, and many of them wrote on the assumption the city had fallen. You know, by the time this is printed, Franco will be in complete control of Madrid and so on. And it looked like that at the time. We certainly expected it ourselves.
Did the name Kim Philby mean anything to you in those days?
No, nor later. I met Philby once only in my life, when he was a correspondent with the Times in Brussels in 1940, when he was a war correspondent with the Times. But I knew nothing of him. I knew the names of the correspondents from the Mail, who were with the Daily Mail was the great supporter of Franco, and I knew the names Cardoso. They had a Portuguese chap who was one of their chief correspondents, I knew their names, but and intermittently the Express had somebody on the Franco side. I was first sent down by the News Chronicle before I went to Madrid. About a month before, I'd been sent down to the Spanish frontier, to the frontier at Irun, to see if I could get in. But they that was when the Chronicle thought they'd have trouble because they said if you come in, we'll put you in jail. So they saved me the trouble by refusing me the visa. But their agent, who was a charming Irishman in Saint-Jean-de-Luz, said, you're a fool to apply. If they let you in, it'll only be to imprison you, because they so hate the News Chronicle that they'd like to have a hostage on their hands. Of course, unfortunately, the News Chronicle provided them with a hostage in the form of Arthur Koestler, who was a Comintern spy. The Chronicle should never have taken on the staff, and who was gathered in Malaga, and they had every reason to arrest him. And he was very lucky to get out alive. And he was, of course, got out by the News Chronicle. But this further confirmed their view that they would have had a rough ride. No, alas, I never had any knowledge of the chaps on the other side. The only thing I did ultimately meet camp was it?
Colonel.